after this morning's session with Dallas, Doug Ward here, ever my personal encourager, said, well, how are you going to follow that? And I have been thrilled to be part of this experience and privileged to be among you. And it's been a profound learning experience for me, and I think for all of us as we have tried to wrap our minds around these issues that go far beyond any remarks that either one of us could make. And as we try to make sense of what God seems to be doing in the midst of his people. And I am awed, A-W-E-D, I am awed by what God is doing in the midst of his people. Just before we went to lunch, there were just a few scattered conversations with various of you. And some of these conversations, in their own way, drop interesting seeds for continued thought. And I would like to verbal or have some of you focus these, and some of you don't know I'm going to do this to you, and I apologize in advance. But Donna and Dale Hill, where are you seated? Okay. Give me a very brief thumbnail of what your concern was, what you were attempting to say, and I'll try and rephrase it. Or echo it, rather, for the mic.
Use the mic.
Okay.
You're welcome to use either of the mics.
Okay, sorry.
I'm a lay person at a church, and been involved in it for a number of years, and love it immensely. And one of the things that we're seeing a little bit in the area of structure is a leadership style of, it's more like the corporate style. It's a CEO, it's kind of an autocratic style, and you see efficiencies in that, maybe in the short term, but one of my concerns is, do you see a team build, an empowering of your lay people? And are you ministering with them, or are you ministering to them? And so that was the question that I asked. Mm-hmm.
And part of the sense I had as we were talking with, you know, Donna and you, Dale, is that the model, as you're experiencing it, is not allowing you to feel that your gifts are being released and used.
Right. Yes.
Okay.
Right.
Because, okay.
Yeah. I don't know if I can really respond to that. Yes, that's true, because you're instructed what to do, and so there's just a certain channel that you go through rather than being able to use those spiritual gifts as God has given you those gifts and empower you in that.
Mm-hmm. So. Okay, thanks. A comment on that observation. Increasingly, people who are writing on behalf of the church are writing in a way that is trying to move us out from those older corporate models and CEO, what is called CEO leadership styles. But just as strongly, there are forces that are trying to keep us in that space. And the pressure on seminaries, for example, to create or produce the kind of leader that strong leader-driven churches feel we need in the Christian community is intense. And seminaries right now are in the space where they are grasping for funding and bodies in order to stay alive. And so they will respond to these kinds of pressures rather than speak to them. And the comment, to at least from my heart, to make on these kinds of this particular kind of model, which has been with us now for a fair amount of time, fair length of time, is when you think about the older corporate style of structure, think about those who are not able to be part of that structure. For example, what role do children play in a corporation? Okay, they have no role. We wait for them to grow up so that they can assume a place, and we create educational experiences for them designed to prepare them for that responsibility in that kind of a model. What about the disadvantaged person in whatever way our society characterizes disadvantage? What space is created for persons who are not or who have some degree of difficulty in certain areas of life? What part do they have in these kinds of models? Do they have any chance at all to speak or to voice or to lead in these kinds of models, this kind of model? What about women? I'm a little touchy at that point. What about retired persons, older persons? What happens to persons who retire from a corporation? In some cases, corporations are hiring them back because they realize they need their wisdom, but in many cases, the gold watch and goodbye. And my concern is that when Christian communities structure themselves corporately that way, that it leaves out huge tracts of people who have no place in that kind of structure. Okay. Mildred, I won't ask you to go to the mic. Do I have the right name here? Joanna, where are you seated? Is she here? Way at the back. Your friend that you were talking to, we were talking together at noon? Mildred? Okay, I won't ask you to go to the mic right now. Let me just verbalize. You were talking about what you tell your children when they're complaining. Say it and then I'll repeat it.
We're not in heaven yet.
Right, we're not in heaven yet. Okay. And the already and not yet feel of the community of faith is reflected in this comment. We're not in heaven yet. And that reminded me of friend and colleague Ted Ward at Trinity, his comment or his observation that organizations really are best conceived of as leaky boats. And they'll never be anything else but leaky boats. And when you think about the person who is in a leaky boat, what does that person do? Bail. And so we spend a lot of our time bailing in leaky boats. That'll never be anything more than leaky boats. Joanna, you were talking about Wycliffe and what you felt to be a positive model of ministry. Say it and I'll try to repeat it. Or yes, go right here.
My husband and I have been involved with Wycliffe, and they've done a lot of work in actually, when they go into a tribe, to contextualize the gospel in the tribe by listening and watching and seeing what the Word of God actually does. Because once the Bible is translated, then the natives have to take it and put it into practice. And they've done written a lot of literature, and part of their course to prepare the people to go into translation work has that aspect to it, like how do you bring the gospel in the culture and how does the culture use the scriptures and contextualize that in their own setting. So that was one.
Okay. Which brought to mind another comment by friend and colleague Ted Ward, who was going to write a book, which he never did because it would be nasty. But he was going to entitle the book a history of what we used to call foreign missions. And the title of the book was Telling God How. And perhaps, there's a sense perhaps in which much of what we do in the things that we're talking about in these last 2 days, we're reacting against that tendency of human nature to tell God how. Okay, last comment here. Reed, where are you? Reed, when you go back to your church, you were saying that you want to be more occupied in?
More occupied in feeding than in leading.
Okay. Feed my sheep. That brought to mind, of course, the passage where that comes from most obviously, John 21, Peter encountering Jesus on the beach. And I think your comment stimulates us to think about leadership differently, or at least it stimulated me, again, to recall a story from the New Testament. And Peter himself, or our friend Simon, is often described as a leader of the early church, which in fact he was. And our memories of him are some of the incidents in the Gospels, but we think of him in the context of the book of Acts and the strength and the power and his preaching that so energized that book, but often forget the pilgrimage of his life through the Gospels and what that says to us about leadership and becoming a leader. And the crisis point in his life when he realized that he had denied the one whom he called his friend and his teacher and his master, and this crisis in his life sending him out. Did he go back, for example, to the upper room where he had said, I will never leave you, though all these leave you, I never will, though all these forsake you, I never will. Did he remember when Jesus met him the first time and Jesus said to him, looking him in the face, you are Simon, you will be called Peter, the rock. Did he remember the many times that Jesus healed, spoke, confronted? And what were these memories to him after Jesus died and all he had left was the memory of his denial? What were those memories to him then? And it strikes me that the incident on the beach, which resulted in these words, feed my sheep, is an absolutely critical passage in the life of a leader, whoever that leader happens to be. And at some point in our lives, if we haven't already, we are going to have to stumble ashore when we realize, from the words of a friend, in this case named John, who looked to the beach at the dawning of the morning and said, it is the Lord. And it was Simon who leapt out of the boat and splashed ashore and up onto that beach. And can you imagine the silence as they stood together alone on that beach? Especially after the last memory that Simon had of being face to face with the Lord was in the courtyard warming his hands after he had denied the Lord three times, and he looked up, and Luke is the only writer who records this. He looked up and Jesus was coming across the courtyard and heard it. And their eyes met again for the last time, and Jesus walked away, and Peter was left with his anguish. And now again, he is on a beach, once again face to face with the Lord. Can you imagine what's going on in his head? And I have a story that I like to tell around this about my father, who's now deceased. I've heard this, but my father was a man who loved machinery, loved his cars. And I had learned, I finally got my driver's license, and with fear and trembling, I realize now, he handed me the keys to his prized 1958 Chev Biscayne. You know, that beautiful model with the rolling fins and blue and white coloring, plastic seats, it was awful. But anyway, He handed me the keys, and I took the young people for our outing to an island near Winnipeg, which is where my home was at the time. And while we, after the outing was over, we all piled back, the group that was with me, piled back into the car. And I was so proud, because I'm a brand new driver driving this group home, and my father trusted me with the keys to his shiny new car. And I didn't remember or realize, I guess, that the back door was open. And I stepped on the accelerator pedal with the transmission in reverse and promptly backed into a tree. Oh. And my memory at this distance, many, many years later, my memory is that I ripped the door right off the back of the car. And but it may not have been that. It may just have been a mild little dent. But the trauma of it was such that I have this memory of driving back to Winnipeg some 40 miles with the trunk, with the door in the trunk, and the commiserations of my friends, you know, as they let them off one by one, you know, see ya, maybe. you know, good luck. And my father had this habit of coming out onto the driveway whenever we came home from anywhere, and just to walk out and greet us, no matter what time of night it was or day it was. And he was there, and he'd just stand on the driveway welcoming us home. And I was wishing with everything in my being that he wouldn't do this. And there he was on the driveway. And so I drove in, and he came around the good side of the car and around the back. And, you know he's welcoming you home while he's inspecting his car. And he came around the back, and he's just standing there, just stood there, looking at this gaping black hole where his door had been. And I stood there, and I'm just saying in my heart, hit me. here's a crowbar. Kill me. There's absolutely nothing you could do to me that would make me feel worse than I feel right now. Because I know what I did to you. There's nothing you could do to me that would make me feel worse than I feel right now. And 6 years later, as we continued to stand on that driveway looking at the gaping hole that was his door, he finally spoke. And he turned to me and he said, was anybody hurt? I said, not yet. And he said, are you okay? And I said, well, yeah, so far. And then after another 6 years pause, he looked me in the eye. He's much taller than I. He looked me in the eye and he said the words that just brought healing and reconciliation in a simple, five-letter sentence, word sentence. We can get it fixed. There was nothing I could do to repair the damage. He had to open that door. And he did it by saying, we can get it fixed. And we did. He did. And I think some of the same dynamic when I think about Peter on the beach. What could he say that would repair the damage that was done in that relationship? What could he do? He did the only thing he could do. He just stood there. And Jesus did the only thing, he did so wonderfully well. He just opened the door of grace and said, Simon, do you love me? Do you love me? And I think everything in Simon's heart was screaming out, yes, you know that I love you. And we don't need to go into all the different nuances of Greek here and the imagery of all that. But those words, feed my sheep, tend my sheep, shepherd my sheep, are important. But they're important in the context of a life story and of lessons learned in that life story. So we go back to feed our sheep or to feed sheep, but we go back aware of processes and life's journeys that have brought us to that point. That leads me to the next stage in this particular session. And that is to speak to well, let me just call it, I think there's a logical imperative in the light of everything that we've been saying and thinking about these last couple of days, that the logical imperative is that theological education has to be for the whole people of God. Okay, it can't be otherwise. And the logical imperative of seeing that leadership is not some special elite class, but leadership could be anyone. Leadership is everyone. And I'm reminded of, we've used this term two or three times through these days, different people have used it, about shepherds and servants and feeding and so on. And it struck me over the noon hours as I was trying to think of how to work this session through with you and trying to think of a format that seemed to make sense, that there's a question there that has to be asked when we talk about the role of leadership as feeding sheep or the role of leadership as being shepherds. And that's fine. I mean, that's a good image. But the question has to be asked, when do sheep become shepherds? And what is the role of the shepherd in creating a climate wherein those sheep can become shepherds? My Jewish friends tell me that it is a shame among them if those who learn never become teachers. And perhaps we could say the same thing, that it is a shame among us if those who are sheep never become shepherds. And there's a sense in which, wouldn't it be glorious if, as we are all taught of God, as the Old Testament says, that we are all leaders in some capacity or other. And all that we then need to worry about are the different functions of leadership, broadly defined, that are present in the body. The other, if you can picture some arms going down here, and all these observations are coming from a box that I have drawn here that says the logical imperative of theological education being for the whole people of God. And if you look at the necessity for sheep to become shepherds and for leadership to be more comprehensive than it is, then what is the nature of theological education for the whole people of God, if that is to be the case? The other side of that is reflecting on what Dallas told us this morning, or was sharing with us this morning, as he tried to describe church. And I was putting a bunch of words together as he was speaking. And I was writing down things such as, the church is to be a redemptive, reconciling, hermeneutical, eschatological community that exists to save the lost. In the way that Dallas was describing that, save the lost, which I thought was just so powerful. The church is to be a redemptive, reconciling, hermeneutical, eschatological community that exists to save the lost. And then another statement, the church is the continuing incarnation of God in Christ, reconciling the world to himself. If those statements are true, the statement about the maturing or the bringing to perfection of the body and members of the body, the sheep becoming shepherds, the sheep becoming leaders. And if it is true that this description of the church is valid, then again we have to ask the question, is it appropriate for there to ever be a theological education that is concerned with the education of a ministerial elite? Are we being asked, led, to move in the direction of thinking of theological education increasingly as for the whole people of God? Now, there is a question in there, and I'll come back to it in a minute, but I want to go down another road for a few moments here. We were talking, Peter and Dallas and I, at the top of the stairs just before this session, And the comments generally were that it would be inappropriate to bring this experience to closure around some quick fixes, or 12 keys to an effective church, or 10 steps when you leave from here, here, here you go, or a book that promises to do this, or a planning model that promises to do that. There are plenty of those out there. But it would be a mistake to bring this particular experience to that kind of closure. And the comment being made that this is an experienced and intelligent and aware group, and that it's appropriate to leave us all floating for a period of time, floating on unresolved questions, floating on top of not clearly defined issues or problems, and floating on the mystery that is the church. And it's appropriate to have that sense of when we go away from here. However, if I might offer, and again reflecting on what Dallas did for us this morning, and as I'm listening to him, trying to think through for myself, what are some of the clues to those models that we seek? What are some of the directions that he's pointing for the way forward? And if I might just suggest to you, in the shortness of time that there was over the noon hour, to just suggest some of this thinking to you and offer it to you for whatever it's worth as clues to models, or however you want to entitle this. It strikes me that it would be, or at least I agree, that it would be a mistake to try and come to operational solutions too soon. And we need to allow not only ourselves, but also the people who are part of our learning communities to soak in some of this material for a time. But some of the things that seem to me, at least, to be coming out of our interactions together over these days are these. That if we are to create any kinds of models from this point on, if we are to be thinking in terms of structures, that there's an observation that Dallas made this morning that I think is profoundly important. And I'll turn this on in a minute. Let me read this to you. I'll turn this back on in a minute. Let me read it to you, because I think this comment is profoundly significant for us at this stage. And I rephrased it, or phrased it this way, or as a question. Is it less a matter of looking for new models than of naming the models that are there and seeking those elements within those models that must be retained and or redeemed? The challenge this morning to say we don't go and create communities, that's God's work. We look for what is there, and we seek God's wisdom about what is there, and we build on what is there. Is it less a matter of looking for new models and new structures than of naming the models that are there and seeking or defining those elements in those models that are able, appropriate, to be retained or that need to be redeemed? A lot of the problem in crafting renewed expressions of forms that enable the fulfillment of function is that we haven't taken the time to recognize what we are and what we have. A lot of the problem in crafting new expressions of forms that enable the fulfillment of function is that we haven't taken the time to recognize what we have or what we are. Okay. Now, with that in mind, going back to this, is it appropriate to think of the way forward, or to think of the purpose of structures as having several pieces to it? Structures that keep before his people the identity and the character that God expects. Now, I'm not going to tell you how to do that. I think the beauty of all of this is that each expression of this will be different. All the way from identifying and naming resident Pharisees to calling people to action that is congruent with what God expects of his people, to keep before his people the identity and character that he expects, to enable the voices of the people to be heard. What kind of structures will allow that to happen appropriately without coercion or without allowing one or more voices to dominate over other voices? To enable the voices of the people to be heard. To enable the various perspectives then that emerge from this process to be informed by the mutual quest for the mind of God. What kind of processes will allow that to happen? To enable the various perspectives to be informed by the mutual quest for the mind of God. Since the Spirit is the only one who knows and can reveal the mind of God, Romans chapter, I've forgotten, no one knows the mind of God except, okay. Since the Spirit reveals the mind of God, what kind of structures then will leave the way open for the Spirit to communicate in the midst of his people? And it may be that some of the structures that we already have are entirely appropriate for this, but we're perhaps not using them as powerfully or as well as we could be, because we don't recognize some of the fundamental purposes that need to be achieved. Structures to, and I put this in quotes, to authorize those voices that confront or admonish or correct. The appropriate voice of the prophet or the wounded teacher, perhaps, in our midst, who comes to the community with humility and says, that is not what God desires of this people, and speaks that voice. How do we authorize, or how do we enable, how do we free that particular person or those persons to have that voice among us? What kind of structures will allow that to happen? 6, structures that embody knowledge and character in action and service and justice. The ministries of the body. Instead of just simply being repetitive, programmatic forms, can they be, in fact, the embodiment of knowledge and character working itself out in action and service and justice? My friend Ted Ward, if ever I had a brother, I would want him to be Ted, says frequently, to know and not to act is not to know. And he has embodied that in his own life. And that modeling has carried itself with great power into the learning community of which I'm a part. Okay, now there's a little more to this. And again, having done this rather quickly, there are probably better ways to do this, but forgive me, the stream of consciousness. Processes embodied in structures that energize structures. Now, these are familiar to us. We let these words fall glibly from our lips when we talk about the church and the work of the church. Worship. And as Dallas was talking about that this morning, I wrote down, worship that brings us before God and obligates a response. And I was, in another thing he said, I wrote down, it is a fearful thing to come before God. And we really do need a mediator. But the awesome thing is that we can, in fact, stand in his presence. And that brought me to the next statement here, again, as I reflected on something Dallas said in response to the question about worship and the purpose of the church not being worship per se in the way that he was talking about this morning. Worship is the habitual condition of the people of God. Is that true? Does that say anything that makes sense? Worship is the habitual condition of the people of God. In other words, we should ever be at worship. It should not be something we just simply reserve for 8:30, 9:30, 10:30, 11:30 on Sunday morning. Worship is the habitual condition of the people of God. And if that is the case, then what kind of corporate structure that goes by the name of the worship of the body will truly be meaningful in the light of this statement, and Dallas's statement, that the function of the body is to go, purpose of the body is to go. And if this is true, then worship is the habitual, ongoing, life-rooted expression of the people of God. So what then becomes the nature of a worship service? What is the purpose of that particular structure? What purpose does it serve? Teaching that broadens the base of knowledge in a context of community and reflection and action. I am an educator, at least that's how I identify myself, and that's how I think about myself. And I think about myself as an educator not so much as someone who tells, but as someone who stimulates thought and who stimulates reflection upon thought and action, and who enables dialogue. That's how I see my role as an educator. I would commend to you a book by Walter Brueggemann called The Canon as a model for, I think the title is A Canon, The Canon as a Model for Biblical Education, something like that. And of course, Brueggemann, being an Old Testament scholar, takes from that that world. And he uses the trilogy of the Torah, which he describes as the ethos of the community, and the prophets, which he describes as the, it's gone right out of my head, the prophets that speak a word when the Torah, in a sense, breaks down, or when the Torah, as it is being interpreted, needs a word from the prophet. And then the writings, or the wisdom, that is the wisdom of the community. Okay, the logos, that's it, the logos of the community, the word of wisdom. The Torah, the ethos of the community, the prophet, the pathos, that's it, the prophet, the pathos of the community, and the writings of the logos of the community. And it's a very interesting book, whether or not you agree with it in every particular. But it's an effort of an Old Testament scholar to bring what he knows to bear upon the task of the church as an educating and educative community. So one wag in the social sciences wrote an article entitled, "What if education were about learning?" What if education were about learning? And yet that's not an utterly disconnected thought from all that I've just said prior to that thought. Service, or ministry, or whatever you want to call it, service that engages the people of God with real issues in societies. We've fallen into the trap, I'm afraid, of embodying service, or a friend of many of us, Don Pastirsky, says we have made structures the channel of ministry and not people. We've made structures the channel of ministry and not people. So what is the nature of service? Now, if we think seriously about all that we've been trying to work with these past couple of days, can we come to these very familiar functions of the church as we know it and think about them freshly? Worship, learning, and service. Can we think about them freshly and describe them freshly and then build structures that allow that freshness to break forth? So another part of my thinking over the noon hour. Well, okay. Processes that enable the structures to work. Some of the things that, as persons who are entrusted with some of these kinds of tasks, processes that enable these structures, or these, processes that enable structures to work. Some of them include, at least in my judgment, some important pieces of this include dialogue, which is being described by some organizational theorists now, very simply, as not just talk. Dialogue, not just talk. And I would commend to you the writings of Chris Argyris, can never remember how to pronounce his name. I believe he's still at Harvard. And Nancy Dixon, who is, I think, at George Washington University. But these two, among others, but these two, I think, to me, have the clearest voices in this regard, are trying to help organizations revision dialogue and what it can be when it's not seen as just talk, but it's really dialogue that has a particular purpose and that really does involve people in very meaningful ways. And it wouldn't be hard for you to find these sources. A literature search will find it for you easily. I don't have... Let me just write down... Okay. Let's see, am I spelling this rightly? Okay, another part of this, Robert, where are you? Over there. Silence. Talk a bit about that experience you were describing.
Yeah, we're in a church community that has a lot of
professional people, and the frenzy of life is so much a part of the reality that people just don't have time. But my wife and I were engaged in conducting a spiritual direction class for the leaders of the church, 2 hours every Tuesday night, and the first half hour was primarily just silence. And that was the part they enjoyed the most. And they came for that just to catch their breath so that then they could receive for the next hour and a half. And that was a very important part of the whole program.
Okay. Silence. Sending our minds and our hearts out to seek God. Colleague of mine, any of you heard of VeggieTales? Who hasn't? No matter whatever you think about VeggieTales, a theologian friend of mine says the 20th century was very hard on God. We killed him in the first part of the 20th century. We turned him into a vegetable and served him up under glass in California. But anyway, okay, whatever. My colleague is the mother of Bob T. Tomato. Okay, the mother of the founder of VeggieTales. And we were talking one time about the need for a new curriculum for children in the church that takes seriously the need to help families be family. And children to be in the midst of family doing things that are important. And so we've got this kind of curriculum underway that, for want of a better term right now, we're calling family catechesis. And trying to get away from that old, the old mindset of what, catechism, but family catechesis. And the pilot that we've been working with recently, and some of this goes back to the work of Sophia Cavalletti, in Italy, and some of it in Jerome Sonia Stewart, Stewart and Berryman. Some of these names some of you will recognize. But creating a space where wonder can be expressed. And the pilot that she did at her church in Barrington, Illinois, near where I live anyway, is to invite families, five or six or eight, I've forgotten how many we had this night, to come to commit to being a cluster of families for about five Sundays, five Sunday nights in this case, and to experience this family catechesis approach and to test it out. And we brought these families together, or they came together, and various processes that went on there, and I won't take the time to go into all of it, but there was a time of just simply being together as families. And then we went from that space to a much more ceremonial space where families were given candles and various symbols of celebration. And we walked together in silence into another room that was set up in a way that focused reflection upon some symbols on a table at the front, scriptures, a candle, a banner, you know, whatever. And there were spaces marked out in that room, tables with food on them, circles on the floor, circular carpets, where families could at some point in the day, evening, go and sit and talk about what they'd experienced that night. And the opening piece of this was Scotty May, my colleague, the mother of VeggieTales, sitting, you know, on her knees, and the format, the teaching format that was used went something like this. And she took out of a box a circle of green cloth, and she said, "I wonder what this is. It is green. It is smooth. I wonder what purpose it serves." She pulled out another, a black cloth, and she spread it out. "I wonder what this is. It is black. It looks dark. I wonder what it does, what it means." She pulled out another piece. "This is blue. I'm going to put it here. I wonder what it could be. Could it be a sky?" And she pulled out various figures, and in each case she was describing it not as "this is," but rather, "I wonder what this is. I wonder what role it could play. I wonder what this means." And I was interested to see the effect that that was having, not only on the adults who were present, but on the children. I'll turn it on again in a minute. There was immediate, profound silence. And Scotty's very quiet voice, in the midst of this silence, calling us into a posture of wonder, out of the silence and in the silence. And the children, down to the youngest two-year-old, were sitting cross-legged on the floor like this, big eyes. And I know enough about children to know that there were some scattered random thoughts going on in those heads, but also that they were trying to figure this out. When Scotty said, "I wonder," and I know enough about kids to know that that was going on. It was a profoundly moving experience. And I believe Bob is right, and Scotty and this experience at her church is having such a profound effect upon families, that we are missing something if we don't incorporate the silence into the midst of the body. Relationship across social conditions, gender, and age, hearing the one or those who are apt to teach and not novices, synthesis and creative proposals for what we might do together as the body, the synthesis of our thought and proposals regarding what we might do together as members of the body in this world. Feasts and festivals organized around the past and present memories of God's acts among his people. Intergenerational learning is another interest of mine, and we just don't have a whole lot of stuff out there that helps us do this real well. Intergenerational learning, for my professional interest, is really needed, absolutely necessary. And so I think another frontier for curriculum development and educational development is in this area. But one of the ways to do intergenerational experiences is to create feasts and to create festivals and to create climates where people can interact and react and act in the midst of these feasts and these festivals. Now, this, branching off from this, a couple of other observations from the morning, and also from some of the comments that you made yesterday and this morning. Periodically, we refer to relevance and contextualization and meeting needs and some of these kinds of matters. And as I reflected on what you were saying, and as I reflected on what Dallas was saying in response to what you were saying, that the church today is in danger of spending all of its time on what is. And then out of that, we identify needs and then out of that we build programs. This is a very common process in the 20th to 20th century church, 21st century church. We are schooled how to go out into our neighborhoods and do demographic analyses and how to look about us and to identify needs. Am I saying to you that it is not appropriate for the church to be concerned about the needs of humanity? I am definitely not saying that to you. But what I am concerned about, and concerned very much, is that this is all that we do. And the dimension that is desperately needed is what I, for want of a better term, would call this what ought dimension. And I believe that part of the purpose of the community of faith, as I hear you expressing it and as I listen to Dallas leading us in the mature insights that he brings to us, is that we recognize this and we do this certainly, but as we do, we are helping persons move in the direction of what God really wants of his people. That statement, living life in light of eternal destiny. Are you going to get any of that if you just camp here? How do we help people, regardless of their station in life, confront eternal destiny? How do we help them find hope in the midst of reality? Again, my friend and my very dear brother, Ted. He worked for many years as a development specialist with USAID, United States Agency for International Development, and was honored by the Doc Hammarskjöld Award in conjunction with the United Nations with an award, the first American ever to receive this award, for his work in developing nations. And he described one day the process of his own maturing as a development specialist. He said, I used to approach development more this way. I would be the one to identify needs and build programs. Then he said, I realized that that's not adequate. Then I became the person who went in the midst of the people and helped them to identify their needs. And then I built programs. He said, that wasn't adequate. He says, now in my later years, he says, I realize that really the task is, if we can name needs and help people identify their needs, that's fine. But it may be that people need to just keep living in their needs. We may not ever be able to fix their needs. And what we need to do is to build a Christian community that, in spite of our needs, in spite of our life circumstance, we are coming to apprehend our eternal destiny. We are coming to have hope in the midst of ongoing, permanent, repetitive reality. And we are helping, to use Dallas's words, helping the lost to find their way and to reintegrate that which is needful into their lives as it is. So, my friends, as we think about leadership and about structure, what goes on in your head, what is going on in your head as you're thinking about that? And then also, because I'm involved most directly in theological education, how do we build a renewed vision for theological education that supports and sustains and energizes the kind of thinking that you're beginning to do now, or the kind of thinking that you're continuing to do? Theological education has consumed itself with a desire to prepare leaders for the church or mission. And the preparatory language is fatally flawed, because you just can't do that. Our task is to continue and to partner in the processes of development as people move forward in ministry. A friend of mine named Rick Dunn, who was a colleague at Trinity for a time and is now at a church in Tennessee, he spoke at a conference I was at not too long ago, and I'd like to just close with this and then get some of your response or reaction. Rick began his conversation with us about the nature of theological education. And he said in the 1980s, extreme sports was the in thing. Now, I used to be extremely athletic. I am no longer. My last excursion into the world of athletics was when I turned 50 several years ago, was to take, to begin again, rather, riding lessons on a horse. And I enjoyed it, and I was learning how to do all the things of jumping over fences and so on. And a real rush to find yourself on the other side of a fence and still on the back of the animal. I have laid that athletic endeavor aside for the time being, because a few months ago I fell and broke my pelvis in two places and didn't know that I had broken it for 7 weeks, thanks to a doctor that didn't think I needed x-rays. But anyway, I am not as much into the field of athletics, but anyway, Rick was describing extreme sports, and he said in extreme sports, the performer was a solo performer competing against the pack, determined to win. The course or the challenge was laid out, structured, timed, controlled. In the 1990s, we have seen the emergence of the eco-challenge sport. Persons work in teams to achieve the goal. The objective is not to win. The objective is to finish the course. All members of the team must win. And Rick gave the example of one team that carried one of its members all the way to the end with a sprained ankle. The member had a sprained ankle. And in order to finish, this team carried this person all the way to the end of the course. The goal is simply given by those who convene the race. The goal is simply given as a direction. You have to go over there somewhere. See that mountain over there? Get there. Any way you can, get there. So the goal is just pointing a direction and not as explicit set of instructions. There are no cones marking a path, no rules, no timing, no regulations. You need to get over there. Now get there any way you can, but finish and do it together. It is assumed in the Eco Challenge that there are values that govern this process: non-violation of the environment, no attempt to destroy other teams. Okay. And he described then, from this, he described what he is beginning to envision as an ecology of education. education as a matrix of experiences in relation to a shared mentored journey. Theological education as an ecology of experiences in relation to a shared mentored journey. I am meeting with Rick and about six or eight other people in Chicago in August. And Rick called us together because he wants to talk about his vision. And he wants to engage dialogue partners who will help him think through this vision. And ultimately to say, okay, if this vision is valid, how do we do it? And interestingly enough, as Rick has been expressing this vision to the members of his church, people have been coming forward with one of those elemental needs, money. And last time I talked to Rick, he said, Linda, so I've got someone who's promised me $22 million if we can make this thing work. Now, my role as a friend of Rick is to keep his feet on the ground and his head in the right space, or to help do that anyway, and there are a number of us that are working with Rick that way. But it's amazing that in so many different quarters, these issues are popping to the surface, and people are getting excited, not only about talking about them, but of trying to find ways forward that are appropriate for the Christian community. Joshua 3 through 5. I would direct you sometime, or invite you sometime, to think about those chapters in a quiet moment. Joshua, now new leader. Moses is off the scene. Joshua, no doubt scared to death. And he's on this side of the Jordan, entrusted with the task of taking this mass of people across the Jordan to the other side, where they begin a new chapter in their life. And it's interesting to me, as I read Joshua chapter 3 through 5, which to me is a wonderful paradigm for what change and transition is all about, one of the first things he does is he walks among the people, encouraging them to remember who they are and what they are as the people of God. He gives them some instruction as how to organize themselves for the journey. He does that because you do those kinds of things. But then he does some other things, a circumcision, because this group of people who had come out of the wilderness had not been circumcised, at least the men. And they celebrate the Passover. And I get the impression that they had not done that for a while. But there's an interesting little phrase tucked into the middle of all of that, that at this point in their journey, as they are readying themselves, and then as they cross the Jordan, at this point in their journey, Joshua is calling them to remember who they are spiritually. That is what's most important. He sends out the priests and the Levites and all that to do that. When they cross the Jordan, and they must have remembered the stories of the Red Sea crossing, okay, as they cross the Jordan, when they get to the other side and they begin to set up life there, little phrase tucked right at the end of one of these chapters, and the manna ceased. And the manna ceased. And there's a temptation just to have run right by those words and not think about the significance. As a new people is going through transition from one way of life to another, that which has sustained them in the past, in God's providence, in God's good pleasure, is no longer adequate to sustain them for this. But there are some things that they have to take with them, and there are some things that they can never let go. And I think that part of the task for us, as we engage congregations in conversation around these issues, is to help people see the difference between what must cease and what must remain. And to be those who make sure that what remains is right there and performed, and that when things cease, we help people grieve and move on. All right, let me stop or I'll keep going forever. We have about, am I right here, 15 minutes to break time, right? Okay. Comments, responses, reactions that you may have or want to speak to this issue. Where would you like to see us go in our thinking as we continue to move in some of these directions or others? Ah, Bill.
Yeah, Linda, on the overhead that you had processes embodied in structures. That energize structures? Yeah, at the bottom. There's nothing that I disagree with on in terms of what you said, but what and maybe I missed it, but it would be a serious absence that I don't see anywhere the proclamation dimension. This all seems to be internal.
Okay.
Worship, teaching, service. Now, the...
Okay, say that again.
Worship, teaching, service, and then, you can use any of the New Testament language that's for that. But what happens in the New Testament, Book of Acts, is that people sort of spontaneously come into the family because they've seen the radical life within. But then there's obviously this verbal proclamation. So there's a spontaneous growth that comes from relationships.
Yeah.
And then there is a growth that comes as the story is naturally and eloquently or brokenly told. And the analogy also eloquently, just the balance. Some of us are better at the broken. And then you used, I believe you used the analogy of a stool, of worship, teaching, service as a stool. But a three-legged stool is inherently unstable. And here you've got a four-legged, which would probably bring you greater stability. But would you comment, why didn't you have that in there? Was it just, you put this together before the class?
Yeah. No intentional reason to leave it out. Just maybe assumed or just didn't enter my head. Yeah.
But does that fit that?
Yeah, it fits to me. Mm-hmm. Okay. Responses, anybody? Add what you will. Delete what you will. Modify what you will.
Perhaps it was understood in your mind, Linda, that proclamation may be included in the word teaching up there.
Possibly. Yeah. Yeah. Proclamation may have been included in the word teaching. Sir, go ahead.
I guess at the start of this conference, the title was The Unnecessary Leader. And I think we've come to agree that it's not leadership that's unnecessary. In fact, that it's vital for the continuation of the work of the church. Maybe what we're really looking at is a different style of leadership or a different model of leadership. And I think we have the sort of CEO model, which directs and organizes people for measurable results, is the one style that we've been reacting against. But it may be that there are other styles. One thing I found really interesting just this past week, doing a class with Walt Wright on leadership, and it seems to me even in secular thinking about leadership, there's actually a move away from that model. And some of the cutting-edge writers are talking a lot more about the role of shaping values and character as the central process in leadership, rather than just missions, strategies, goals, and organization, and so on. And it seemed to me that maybe some of that thinking we can also engage with, a very strong emphasis on leaders as shaping values and character, which I think is the heart of what I hear you saying, is that it's not just the externals, we've got to deal with the internal heart issues first. And then also a lot of writing on leadership and credibility and character being centrally important and so on. So I think maybe there's a lot more that we can engage with as moving away from a model of leadership which is not helpful, but not combining all leadership in the same package, as it were.
Okay, thank you. Permit me, if you will, to respond to that in a rather personal way. I've come to believe that there are some stages in our understanding of vocation, our personal vocation, and stages in leadership, if you will. I don't, you know, whatever words you use. But in my own life, tracking a time when everything was fine. My life was organized around, Jesus seemed to be part of my life, and everything was great, no cracks, no flaws, no doubts. But it didn't take very long as you begin in your vocation, your ministry, whether you're professional or lay, leader, whatever those terms mean, that there are some cracks that begin to appear, edges of doubt. And that's not altogether unhealthy. In my case, and I think this is becoming true increasingly as I talk with people, that another stage, if you like, of that is that we come to the point where we begin to believe that God is absent. It's, you know, God is no longer dead. I don't think there'd be very many people in our society today who would say God is dead. They're more likely to say God is absent. And I think even for Christians, certainly in my case, coming to a point not all that many years ago, incidentally, where a profound feeling that God was absent. And yet, as I struggled with that feeling in the privacy of my own heart, I could perform, sometimes well, the tasks of my vocation. I could teach, I could lead Bible studies, I could open and close meetings with prayer, I could even preach, I can write curriculum, I can do all those things, but having this incredible sense that God was absent. And it was, I lived with that for many, many years, even while I was employed as a professor at Trinity. Could I speak about that to anybody? Could I stand up in a faculty meeting and say, I think God is absent from my life, and I'm just going through the motions? I didn't feel I could even do that. Could I share that in my church? No, because I'm the professional Christian. And if I share that, my goodness, what's that going to do? It could destroy the body. And so I lived with this for years. What, you know, some are fond of saying the dark night of the soul. I don't ever want to go there again. And who knows, you may have to. But coming to a point, and I'm not enough of a Calvinist to say that I could not have walked away from God, from my vocation, from my faith. That close. And I remember one Tuesday, there were three, in this case, three men in my life at this point that I shared some of this with, Ted Ward, Walt Liefeld, and Paul Hebert. And the fact that they were men, don't let it worry you. The fact that they were older men, don't let that worry you either. But they just happened to be the right persons in my life at that point. And interestingly enough, not one of them gave me advice. Not one of them encouraged me and said, oh, you'll be okay. Not one of them pointed me to texts in the Bible that would fix my condition. Not one of them even offered to pray with me. What they did was not to abandon me, not to criticize me, not to make trivial my journey, not to give me an answer. What they did, they stood beside me. For years, they were quiet presence in my life. And they walked with me, and most often without saying a word. One Tuesday, I was standing beside Walt, sharing with him a story that I had written on the life of Mary. And coming to the end of that story and her trauma of being the mother of Jesus and realizing that he died. And is it some fault, some failure in my belief that my son died? But going through all of that and what she must have been experiencing and coming to the end and the resolution of all of that in Acts chapter 1:14, where the whole list is given of the people who are in the upper room and the little phrase at the end of that verse, all these people are named as being in the upper room and Mary, the mother of Jesus, and his brothers. And I thought, wow, what a resolution of a journey. And I was showing this to Walt, and he looked at me, and he said, "Have you come to this point yet?" And that's the first time he'd ever spoken to me that way. And I said, "Walt, I just don't know." And he left. He'd come by the house to deliver a jacket because I left my jacket in a bar, and I'll let you go wherever you want to go with that. And then the next Friday, I was in the quiet of my bedroom and feeling almost literally pushed to my knees and having to make a choice. Either I give this whole thing up and abandon it completely, or I just say, "I have no idea what this is all about. I don't understand it. I don't even understand my pain. But if I have to live with it, fine. I will stay with it. Please help." And from that moment on, it was like things opened up. And I'm not saying that there's all kinds of answers, but there's a whole new way of looking at life right now, and I must say to you, a whole new way of looking at leadership. And our brother's comment here about, capture the in the two or three words you use what you said.
Maybe driven by values,
yeah.
Character,
right.
Capability.
Right, and coming out of some of that, coming out of our own journey with God. And part of the leadership journey is recognizing what God is doing in our lives and allowing it to happen. What really sobered me and saddened me in my own self is that I did not feel I could process this with the Christian community. Perhaps I could have. You know, it may have just been me and my pride. But whatever the reason, I didn't. But oh, thank God for three people who just stood there and were not like the friends of Job. Okay, sorry about that. I've left you with 3 minutes. Yes.
Can I ask you a question?
Hold on.
Thank you. My question was, in the diagram you put up with what is, and perhaps we ought to look more at what ought to be. Could you comment on maybe that the problem is not that we don't do it, but maybe we do it so articulately in words that's not backed up by how we then choose to live becomes a problem, and that relates exactly to what you've just said. It wasn't people that gave you advice or told you where to go and how to get there, but we're simply with you. And so my fear is that we rush out of here and start to proclaim even stronger what ought to be, and perhaps that's been exactly the problem.
Okay. All right. That is a wonderful caution, that the what ought cannot be engineered any more than, anything else. Okay, to allow God, is this what you're saying? To allow God to be the one who leads us to that what ought, and we are shepherds with that, or we are helpers in that process. Good caution. Thank you. Yeah.
The what we instead of phrasing it what ought to be, we and we're conscious that God commands, but instead the bigger vision is what could be. And that all of a sudden releases us into, and I'm a Baptist, but the dance. Mm-hmm. The dance that he calls us to. Mm-hmm. And the joy that comes because we're pressing for possibilities that he alone can unfold, and his commands are part of that, but I feel like they're only part. It's bigger. Mm-hmm. And so when I saw that word ought to be, I thought, this is too heavy. So the same kind of response, what could be.
Love it. Thanks.